This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Clermont, November 2005.
Thank you, Brian and Gail, conveners of the Jewish Emphasis Week, Rabbi and Mrs. Liebenberg, Rabbi Kahn. Ladies and gentlemen, that story sounded a little bit too close to home, the story of the rabbi and the old man. I was consulting to an extremely highly profitable section of an extremely highly profitable bank a few months ago, and I knew that the manager in charge of this section didn't really think all that much of the work that I do. So I said to him, I'm really surprised. Firstly, you're doing quite well. Secondly, why would you be using my services? And he says, well, I don't really know if it's your strategies that are any good or whether you just give a blessing, but somehow whenever you've been at a department, they seem to do a whole lot better. So we thought we would use them. In a world of accelerating change, growing uncertainty, and a great deal of boundarylessness, the Jewish person is uniquely anchored and positioned to lead. And I'm going to briefly sketch some of the changes in the world, as I see it anyway. Some of the uncertainties, some of the growing boundarylessness, and then look inwards at some of our insights in the Torah, particularly around the parasha that we've just completed, to see whether we can see some kind of an approach to help us navigate the very turbulent times that lie ahead of us. Firstly, as far as change itself is concerned, a man called Dick Brown was appointed as head of EDS, at the time the largest computer software company in the world. And his job was to turn this thing around. It wasn't doing too well. And he was describing to me some of the things that he did. But he said the very first thing that scared him was everybody told him, be careful, not too much change at once. People don't like change. And so he decided he would test that. All the consultants were telling him, careful with the change, not too much, because he was just ready to go crazy and change everything immediately. And so he decided he would test the theory. And on a Friday afternoon, he said to his secretary, I want to see you first thing on Monday morning to discuss some new responsibilities and expanded roles for you. She said, fine. Monday morning, she walks in and he says to her, how was your weekend? She said, it was wonderful. He said, were you nervous? No, she said, I was excited. And he said, what would have happened had I said to you on Friday, I want to see you on Monday about your job? Would you have then had a nice weekend? She said, I wouldn't have slept. And Dick Brown said to me, what was the difference between those two? Both of them involved change. She knew something was going to change on Monday. One piece of communication left her excited about the change and one fearful about the change. And so Dick Brown said to me, people are not fearful of change. People love change. Would you like to go on vacation to the same place every single... I know there are some people who do that, but generally, do people like going to the same place every single year? Or do we like to vary it a little bit? Do we like to go out to the same restaurant every time we go out for a meal? Or do we like to try something new? No choice. We're not afraid of change. We enjoy change. We're afraid of boredom. But what we're most afraid of is uncertainty. What we're most afraid of is the unknown. That was confirmed by another fellow called Brown, a man called Donald Brown, who wrote a book called The Human Universals, after researching hundreds of different cultures to find out what are some of the common beliefs of all these different cultures. And he found 372 common beliefs. some of them very silly and unimportant, but the most important common belief was the fear of the future. And that's why in every culture, seers of the future have a special status. In some cultures they're called seers, in some cultures they're called witch doctors, in some cultures they're called prophets, in some cultures they're called economists. But they all try and predict the future, because we feel more comfortable if we have a sense of what the future is going to be. And the kind of times we're living in now don't really allow us that luxury to know much about what the future is going to be. But let's have a little bit of it. Let's look at a sketch of what it might be. Try and understand some of the principles of that future, and then look at how we tend to manage them. Now, one of the ways we try to create certainty is by building boundaries. Areas in which we can control our own destiny. So we build boundaries around our families, we build boundaries around our businesses, we build national boundaries, we build religious boundaries. However, since the time of the French Revolution, the Western world has been systematically setting about the demolition of boundaries. Demolishing political boundaries, demolishing ideological boundaries, demolishing national boundaries. And today the world is probably more globalized and boundaryless than it has ever been before. And that boundaryness creates enormous insecurity and uncertainty. The bigger a community of people, the more insecure each individual is. The bigger a community of people, the less personality and character develops in its individual members. And in this boundaryless world that we're talking of, there's a confluence of four trends that create the conditions for unprecedented turbulence, I believe. The four trends are what I call liberal democracy, democracy taken to an extreme. I know some people think democracy cannot be taken to an extreme, but it can. Everything can be taken to an extreme. Zero or negative population growth in certain countries in the Western world. The third one is globalization. And the fourth is what the New York Times last week called the Google effect. And we'll talk about that. Liberal democracy is the extreme embracing of cultural diversity. Now that doesn't sound such a bad thing on its own. Different cultures coming together, understanding each other's cultures, enjoying each other's cultures. Not a serious problem. But the embracing of cultural diversity leads to the next step, which is the acceptance of ethical diversity. Which is, now as long as I can explain that the reason I behave badly is because that's my cultural background, you have to keep quiet and accept it. And that starts creating some interesting impacts. The American government asked me to go to one of its territories in Asia where bribery was rampant, even in government and senior government offices, on the basis that it was part of their culture. And that in fact was so. When I got there, they gave me the name. The name was called Chinchuli, and Chinchuli means gift-giving. And they said, we're not like the Americans, although they tried desperately to get green cards and passports. But they said, we give gifts to one another. We show our appreciation. We don't expect things for nothing. If we ask a favor from an official, we bring them a gift. If an official wants us to do something for them, they give us a gift. That's how it works. It's part of our culture, and the Americans must accept that. The only way I could deal with that ultimately was to convince them that it was part of their culture to give gifts from their own resources, but not to give gifts from somebody else's resources, which they had to accept. And then I simply had to teach them that the government's funds was not their own resources. Even if they're officials of the government, they don't own government funds. And therefore, if they wanted to give bribes, that was fine, but they should pay for it themselves. And if they wanted to accept bribes, that's fine, but the bribes should then go into the government's treasury and not into their own. So we begin to have to tolerate ethical diversity as an outcome of embracing cultural diversity. And then the next step is the bullying tactics of political correctness. Now you can no longer talk the truth. Now you can no longer confront people about their beliefs or behavior because it's just not politically correct to do so. So now everybody is very careful. Not only are we tolerating each other, but we're not even conducting any kind of honest interaction with one another. And then there's equal rights. Everybody, no matter where they come from, who they are, and how they behave, are entitled to the same rights. And the openness of national borders. The zero or negative population growth in Western countries is self-evident. Globalization in four different areas, starting with transport in the old days, transcontinental railway systems, and now intercontinental air travel, and communication, telegraph, telephone, radio, satellite, internet, in business, the quick and free diffusion of information, removal of tariff barriers, and political globalization, the downfall of the Iron Curtain, the unity or the attempted unification of Europe, are some of the symptoms we see of this enormous trend towards globalization. And the Google effect is the free and instant access to comparative information. So in an instant, anybody in the world can get comparative pricing on any product anywhere in the world. Now, why are these four trends so impactful in the developing of conditions that are ripe for turbulence? Let's have a look at them and see. Number one. One turbulent storm on the horizon is the one that I call colliding worlds. What are the colliding worlds? Which are the worlds, and where and why are they colliding? Globalization and the Google effect come together to create the conditions for colliding worlds. What have they got to do with each other? Well, it's very simple. I needed to convert a whole lot of audio tapes to MP3 format. I got some quotes in the United States around $9 to $10 a tape. I got a quote in South Africa, 170 rand a tape. Can't understand it, but those were the quotes I was getting. I got a quote in India, $1.10 per tape. Turnaround time in the United States was about 6 months for the number of tapes that I had. The turnaround time in South Africa was the same, but they couldn't guarantee it. The turnaround in time in India was 2 weeks, and they could guarantee it. So what happens? The Indian gets the job and some South African or American doesn't. And one asks, how is it possible? There's labor involved. The tapes are an hour each. It takes at least an hour's time in real time to transfer them. You need somebody sitting there doing it, plus you need some technology. Well, Asia is willing to do a whole lot of stuff, firstly at very low cost, because they're willing to live on very low standards still, but they're also willing to take losses. Somebody asked me the other day, how long can China do work at below cost? And my answer was, for a few hundred years. Because we also do things below cost. We also sell below cost in order to attract customers. We have loss leaders. We know what that is. But we have short time horizons. We do it for a short period of time. We want to see the increase in volume in other areas in our business, and then we get back to normal. Well, China works on longer time frames. So if for strategic purposes, China wants to destroy the West, and it's going to take them 50 years, well, that's okay. No problem. They're willing to do that. So we're dealing with completely different time frames, and globalization and the Google effect. The fact that I can click onto Google and find out in minutes where in the world I can get my product or service at the lowest price, and the fact that globalization enables me to send the material over, to get it back, to send it electronically, get it back the next day, means that there's no reason why I shouldn't use the cheapest provider wherever in the world he or she may be. America's response is, when I say to the Americans, so what are you doing about this, guys? Do you realize your economy is about to be wiped out? What do they answer? Oh, don't worry. We own China. We get into relationships, into partnerships, and we make sure that the fact that it's being produced at such low cost in China is of benefit to our shareholders, because we have shares in those very production houses that are offering you those low costs. So we don't really care if our American production ceases to exist, which has already just about happened, and we shift our production to India or to China or to South America. What America hasn't quite realized is that China is not interested in partnerships. China is interested in two steps. Step number one, learn how to do it. Step number two, wipe them off the face of the earth. Once we've learned how to do it, we will destroy them. They're not going to remain in partnerships with American companies out of a sense of gratitude. Thank you for teaching us your technology, and in return you can have half of our products. That's not what they're going to do in the long term. And so the outsourcing of American jobs, declining standards of education, and the demographic change in the United States will, I believe, cause the United States to evolve from a world leader to a third world leader, where there'll be an increasing gap in wealth between a very small elite who has a great deal and large masses of people who have very little. What about the vanishing cultures? Well, here's the confluence of liberal democracy and the zero population growth in certain Western countries. The liberal democracy means open the borders, let anybody in, because we embrace diversity, we're tolerant of everybody. Come and join us. The fact is, you have 9, 10, 12 children per family. We have 1 or 2 children per family. That's okay. We embrace your culture. Come and join us. Why did nobody do the maths? Why did nobody realize that it doesn't take very long for 10% of France's population to be Muslim? And 10% of France's population, by the way, doesn't mean 10% of Paris's population, because that 10% lives in Paris and a few other cities. So in Paris it's over 30% is Muslim. So Paris is shortly to cease to be a French city. What does that do to French culture? I chose this title long before the current problems in France. And France is not the only European country that's feeling that. Because liberal democracy not only invites immigrants into a country, which is fine, but also invites them to bring their cultures with them, and as they gain majority, to impose those cultures on their host countries. So it's not just in Europe. In the United States we see it in a slightly different way. In California, a country that has an enormous influence on United States politics and the economy. California is the 6th largest economy in the world. It's probably the most important state in the election of the president. Whites are in the minority in California. 74% of all Los Angeles school children are Hispanic. That's not good or bad, it just means it's different. California is not going to be the same California in 10 years' time as it was 10 years ago. Los Angeles has its first Latino mayor. And it's beyond California. In the United States, over 70% of college graduates are illiterate even in their own languages. There's a confusion taking place and a deterioration of education standards. And there's also a huge moral relativism in the United States and in Europe. We've got all these different cultures, they've got different moral outlooks, and who's to say who's right? So everybody's right. If everybody's right, somewhere or other you'll find some culture that believes what you do is right or is okay, and morality becomes enormously questionable and questioned. What about competing religions? Part of the American response to liberal democracy has been Christian fundamentalism. Now, I need to explain to you that American Christian fundamentalism is very different from European Christian fundamentalism. And they're different in many ways, but as far as the Jews are concerned, the most important difference is American Christian fundamentals love the Jews, they love Israel, and they need Israel to be successful. That's very different from the European Christian fundamentalist. In Europe, in the Vatican and elsewhere, Israel has been a perplexing theological problem. Because if the Jews were wrong in not following Jesus, why do they have a state of their own now? Why weren't they wiped out long ago by God? Serious theological problem, which caused the Vatican not to recognize Israel, not to recognize Jerusalem for a very long time. The American Christian sees it very differently. The American Christian sees the Jews as ultimately accepting Jesus, but it will be a much bigger Kiddush Hashem If the Jews do that, once they've been incredibly successful and their state has been established as in the prophecies. So they want all the prophecies of Tanakh to come true, and then we're going to say, oh my goodness, there's one little mistake, we didn't realize that Yoshua was the guy, we're sorry, we now accept him. But leaving that aside, until we get there, they are very determined to make sure that Israel succeeds. My brother's quite close to the Christian right in the United States, and he was invited to speak at a church, one of their not the service, was some celebration, and he calls them up and he says, just preparing my speech about how many people will there be there, and they said 100,000. He said, no, not including television. They said, no, including television it's well over 8 million. 100,000 will be in the hall. That's the size of the thing. We have no concept. He arrives there, and it's like Disneyland. There's parking, and you bust to the hall, and there's this huge stadium. It's not even a hall, it's a stadium. Full of very devout Christian people. And it starts off, and they sing Tehillim, they sing the Psalms, and the words are flashed on big screens. They have a huge orchestra. It's very beautiful and inspiring, he tells me. We were having a discussion at dinner time whether there's really a need for chazonim and choirs and what part do they play, and so this is no chazon choir, this is like a 150 piece orchestra. They're really serious about their tehillim, about their prayers. But the most surprising thing of all was, on the dais, together with my brother, were two other Orthodox rabbis, one wearing a knitted kippah and one a chosid with a shtreimel in full regalia. This was a huge shock to my brother. He didn't know what was going on. And the pastor gets up and he begins to introduce my brother, and he says, before I do that, just a couple of points. He says, do we love Israel? And 100,000 people said, yes, we love Israel. And he said, wrong. We don't just love Israel, we're passionate about Israel. Yes, we're passionate about 100,000 people. Don't get Jews saying that. 100,000. And he's asked by a show of hands, how many of you have been to Israel this year? And half of them put up their hands. And how many went last year? And another half put up their hands. How many will go next year? Another half. I want you to go twice a year, he says to them. Not once a year, twice a year. And he says, in fact, I was in there, and my wife flew back a little before me, and she was sitting in the plane, and next to her was sitting Rabbi so-and-so, points him out. And he told her about the work his organization was doing at a certain orphanage in the north of Israel, and she became so excited, she invited him this evening so that we could honor him. And I would like to call him up to accept a small donation from us in support of his cause. He was in an envelope. That's the same to the second rabbi. Afterwards, my brother's quite interested, and he goes up to the chosid, and he says, interesting, what was in the envelope? $1 million. I don't know what the second one got. We have no idea of the support we're getting from the Christian right in Israel, in the United States. So they're different. But they're also fundamentalist. The Middle East and parts of Southeast Asia have responded to liberal democracy and globalization because to them, by the way, globalization means the advancement of American imperialism. So to the Muslim world, that's what globalization means. It's a terrible thing, something to be stopped. And they've responded with Islamic fundamentalism. And even if, as they say, only 10% of Muslims are extreme, that makes it, how many people? Sorry? 100 million. Yeah, I think that makes it a billion. Is that right? Makes it 100 million. That's a lot of Muslims. Or extreme fundamentalists. And Christian fundamentalism and Muslim fundamentalism are fundamentally irreconcilable. There's no way they can accept each other. So we have some competing religions. What about Europe? How's Europe responding? Well, Europe hasn't figured out yet how to respond. They've got their own troubles right now. There was a very interesting article written by a non-Jewish journalist. Some of you might have seen it. It got quite widely circulated. A non-Jewish journalist, I think he was walking around Barcelona and had a look at what was happening, and said, you know, we didn't exterminate the Jews in Auschwitz. We exterminated Europe. because we exchanged a life-loving, contributive minority for a death-loving, sapping minority. We exchanged the Jews for the Muslims. That's what we did at Auschwitz. Now, that approach isn't going to get them a whole lot far either. What will their approach be? I don't know. But if we look at historic precedent, we shouldn't be too surprised if Europe's response is collusion with their Muslim citizens and allies to blame the Jews and Israel. Wouldn't be a very surprising thing. In which case, what does the world begin to look like? We at least want to get some kind of clarity about the future, even if it's not a comfortable one. Then the future would look like a substantially weakened United States, unremittingly striving to cling to its economic power in the face of a newly emerging force of China and India. That would be one part of it. A docile and deteriorating Europe, allying itself increasingly with the Muslim world. Israel fighting for its survival against a hostile Europe and Muslim world with a weakened America as its ally. And relentless pressure on Israel to either remove its border with the Palestinians and grant them the rights of Israeli citizens, or grant them independence. And I believe, I have no basis to say this other than my own analysis, that that's what's been going on in Ariel Sharon's head. He's not an idiot. He didn't want to do what happened any more than anybody else wanted it done. But he foresaw what we're talking about, or foresees what we're talking about. As boundarylessness and globalization continue, as liberal democracy finds greater and greater ground, Israel is going to become under enormous pressure from its one remaining ally, the United States. You've got to democratize. You cannot be a non-democratic country. That means you have two choices. Either give the Arabs citizenship, in which case you eradicate Israel instantly, or give them independence, in which case you put the lives of Jewish settlers at risk. And it's quite clear to Ariel Sharon that there's only one alternative. We have to get the Jews out of those areas. We have to give them independence and get on with our lives. Because the threat of liberal democracy is greater for Israel than the threat of Islamic fundamentalism. Islamic fundamentalism on its own, the Israelis can handle. Liberal democracy on its own, I guess, the Israelis can handle. But liberal democracy demanding citizenship for Islamic fundamentalists creates a problem for Israel that Europe will have to face eventually too. But the problem for Israel will be a little bit more serious. So it's not really a very pretty picture if we look at where the world is going, unless you live in China or India perhaps. But what is the role of the Jew in all this change and turbulence? In a polarized world trapped between the extremes, where are we? Are we somewhere in the middle of these extremes? Are we somewhere between East and West? Are we somewhere between the Christians and the Muslims? Are we on one side or the other? Where are we? Who are we? So let's learn a little bit of Torah and figure out quite an interesting position of where we are. And here, if you look at the pages that we've handed out to you, I'm going to refer to some of the sources that I've translated into English, and we'll work our way through them. Firstly, a principle that we say every morning. Ushtei ketuvim hamakhishim ze et ze ad sheyavo haketuv hashlishi v'yachriya b'neihem. Two verses might contradict one another until a third verse comes and resolves them. See, when you think in a linear fashion, if you have two principles or two positions in an argument, one on one side of the spectrum and one on the other side of the spectrum, what's our immediate tendency? How do you resolve it? Compromise. Compromise ensures falsehood. Because if either A is true or B is true, one thing we know for sure, the middle is false. So if you went A, there's a 50% chance of being right. If you went B, there's a 50% chance of being right. But if you go somewhere in the middle, there's a 0% chance of being right. If A and B are arguing over an amount of money and you're awarded to A, you make 50% of the litigants happy. If you're awarded to B, you make 50% of the litigants happy. If you give it somewhere in the middle, you make everybody unhappy. So compromise, believe it or not, is not the Jewish, it's not the Torah method of resolving problems that defy resolution. If a problem defies resolution, if there's an A and there's a B, and they both seem right, but they can't both be right. The Talmud teaches us in this quote, there's a third dimension missing. Find the third dimension, because that's where the solution lies. The solution doesn't lie on the spectrum. The solution lies by changing the shape of the spectrum. The bright light on the horizon is a Medrash, quote number 2, when you see kingdoms battling one another, look out for the footprint of Mashiach. In the days of Abraham, because kingdoms battled one another, the Medrash makes this comment in the story of the four kings battling the five kings and Abraham getting involved in the process, redemption came to Abraham. So it's not so bad when there's massive conflict taking place in the world. It might bring a period of uncertainty and pain, but usually there's positive outcome for the Jewish people. Now, if I'd spoken this way in 1939 or 40 or 41, people would have thought I was crazy. But if I'd said that in 1948, people would have said, aha, ultimately something good comes out for the Jewish people if we just survive the turbulence, if we just navigate our way through it. We begin to see the footprints of Mashiach when the big powers of the world begin to battle it out. And the big powers of the world began to battle it out during the First World War. And they continued to battle it out during the Second World War. And 100 years is not a long time in human history. And they continued to battle it out through the Cold War. And now they're aligning themselves for a new battle, I believe. And it might not be a military battle. Might just be an economic battle. It might be a religious battle. But the battle between Islam and Christianity and between Asia and the West are two major battles that are just beginning to form themselves. And we should watch out for the footprints of Mashiach as we see this happening. Now let's try and find this third verse. There's East and there's West. There's Islam and there's Christianity. Capitalism and this free markets and this controlled economies. Where are we? Where is the third dimension? The Torah tells us at the beginning of the parasha before last week that Noah was a tzaddik, he was a righteous man, bedorotav, in his generations. And Rashi comments in quote number 3, according to his generation he was righteous, but had he lived in the generation of Abraham he would not have been thought of as anything. That's a fine comment to make. We could say that about anybody. Say the Chofetz Chaim was a tzaddik. Yeah, but if he lived in Avraham's generation, would he have been such a tzaddik compared to Abraham? Who knows? Maybe yes, maybe no. But nobody would have stood up that well to Abraham, our forefather. The Torah tells us he was a righteous man. Why does Rashi comment? Yeah, he was righteous because there was nobody better than him. He didn't have much competition. But if he would have been in the time of Abraham, he wouldn't have been such a righteous man. What does that mean? What I want to suggest to you is imagine a spectrum from 0 to 10, righteousness. Person is on 0 is a wicked man. Person is on 10 is a tzaddik. So what does the Torah tell us? Where is Noah? He's on 10. That's fine. We don't really understand Rashi then. How can you be better than 10? Who cares where Avraham is? Avraham would also be 10. That doesn't mean you've got to push Noah off the scale because of Avraham being a 10. But if now you take that spectrum from 0 to 10 and you add to that x-axis a y-axis, a vertical axis, also from 0 to 10, what happens now? Noach is in the bottom right-hand corner, isn't he? And what happens if you've got somebody who's 10 on both scales? Then he's in the top right-hand corner. That's very different. That's the Ketuvah Shlishi. When you add a third dimension, your parameters of measurement change. When you add a third dimension, your way of viewing the world changes. If you're looking at Noach just on a 0 to 10 linear scale, he's a 10, great. The Torah tells us, study. But if you add a height dimension, and you use a different measurement, an additional qualitative measurement, there he doesn't feature. So what was that additional dimension that Avraham innovated? Because in Noach we have universal cultures. In Noach we have the father of mankind. In Avraham we have Jewish culture. So what is it that Rashi says that Noach was great in non-Jewish civilization, but if he were weighed up in Jewish civilization, he wouldn't have counted for much? What is the difference? The opening words of last week's parsha. I'm still on last week. I haven't started learning next week's parsha. This Shabbos' parsha yet. We'll talk about that on Shabbos, but I'm still on last week. The opening words of last week's parsha. God says to Avraham, Lech lecha mi'artzecha mi'radah. Go, leave your home, your land, your birthplace, your father's home, and go to a land which I'll show you. I'm not even going to name it. Now we talk about people being afraid of uncertainty. Imagine that. Being told, emigrate, and I'll tell you once you're on the way where you're going. And not even once you're on the way. When you get there, I'll say, ah, this is the place. Not an easy task. But there's something different. If you look at that verse, God does give him a destination, but he gives him a different destination because there's another way to translate lech lecha. We normally translate lech lecha meaning go for your own good. But lech lecha might mean something else. Lech lecha might also mean lech, go, lecha. What does that mean? To yourself. Avraham, you found me. Go and find yourself now. Look for yourself. Go and find Avraham. Go and find the God in Avraham, not the God in the world. You've found the God in the world. You've determined that the world must have a creator. You've determined that there's a God that controls and masters the world. You're right. I am He. Now go and find the me that's inside you. And the verse continues and says, and I will make your name great and I will give you money and I'll take care of you. And then it says at the end of the next sentence, Veheye brocha, and be a blessing. But there's an interesting punctuation under Veheye. The trop, the way we sing it, determines the punctuation. There's a semicolon after Veheye. So it then reads, Veheye, and be bracha, blessing. So if we now read the sentence that way, quite an innovative way of reading it, Lech lecha Avraham, this would be quite modern and existential. God would be saying, Avraham, you found me, lech lecha, go now on a journey to find yourself. And just to be, because that's your next task, just be. And the story then starts unfolding. Now what did Avraham discover in that next part that becomes so crucial? We find that in an interaction between him and Malki Tzedek, which we quote in quote number 4. He's just saved the king of Sodom and the king of Amorah, and Malki Tzedek comes out and blesses Avraham and said, blessed is Avraham to the Most High God who owns heaven and earth. Baruch Lekel Elyon, to the highest God. In a sentence or two later, Avraham says to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hands to Hashem, the Most High God who owns heaven and earth. He uses exactly the same phrase as Malki Tzedek. Malki Tzedek, by the way, was Shem, who was the son of Noach. So Malki Tzedek is a Noachide. And Avraham adopts his phrase, the Most High God who owns heaven and earth. But what is the difference? He adds one word. What is the word that he adds? Hashem. Which in Hebrew is spelled Yud Kei Vav Kei, which means the God of being, the God of existence, the God of creation. So if we look at that and we say, where is Malki Tzedek and where is Avraham? Malki Tzedek believes in God. Malki Tzedek praises Avraham and says, blessed you to the Most High God. Malki Tzedek was Shem, who had a yeshiva. He was teaching about God. So we have to ask, what was Avraham's big discovery? If Shem not knew about God, Shem, his son, knew about God, was teaching about God. When Abraham meets Melchizedek, Melchizedek greets him with blessings in the name of the Most High God who owns heaven and earth. Didn't Abraham say to him, "Hey Melchizedek, how did you know about God? That's my thing. Where did you get it from? That's patented. That's copyright." Melchizedek, "I've known it all the time." Abraham says, "Yes, you knew that, but you didn't know Yud Kei Vav Kei. You knew the God, Kel Elyon, the God who is master of all forces, the God who is master of all energies. You know God the judge. You know God the absolute. But what about the existential God, the God who exists inside each one of us that we can access internally, that we can find intuitively? What about the divine spark that each individual has? Do you, Melchizedek, know how to access that part of God? Because that's the same God." And that's why Abraham says, Hashem Kel Elyon. It's not sufficient to recognize God, the master of the universe. We also need to realize that that God is the same God that dwells deeply inside us. That God is the same God we can experience and feel in quiet moments, when we're watching a sunset, when we're listening to magnificent music, when we're sitting in shul, we're davening, or we're hearing a chazan davening. We can hear and feel a God inside us. That's the same God, not a different God. And then Abraham goes on to say to the king of Sodom, who had offered him some property, and he says, "Whether from a thread and unto a shoelace, I will not take a single item from anything that is yours, so that never could you say, it is I who has made Abraham rich." Here's his philosophy of life. I will take nothing. I'm not a consumer of goods. I'm not a taker. I'm a giver. I'm a contributor. I'm a generator of wealth, not a consumer of wealth. And my wealth will never be attributable to you, King of Sodom. Let's look at one more piece in the Torah, and then we'll tie it together. God eventually says to Abraham, also in last week's parasha, "And no longer will your name be called Abraham, but your name will be Avraham, for I have appointed you the father of multitudes of nations." Av Hamon Goyim, the father of many nations. And the Netziv explains that Avraham's role changes at that point. Up until that time, Avraham's following were his converts. He converted people. He taught them Torah, he taught them about God, he taught them the seven Noahide laws, and he converted them into faithful followers. But you can't do that universally. Now explains the Netziv, Abraham is meant to lead the world, not just to lead a few individuals. And leading the world does not mean converting the world to Judaism. Leading the world means allowing each nation to develop its own way of serving God, but recognizing that there's only one God, that there's a God that demands one morality, one ethic, that there should be an integrity, a religious integrity, even though there's a diversity of ritualistic expression. Avraham's role was no longer to convert. Avraham's role was no longer to convince others to join his religion, but it was to influence people to live moral and upright lives and to rid the world of idolatry. That's all he had to do. Rid the world of idolatry. Now in these little sections we really have the core of the Jewish response to our changing world. Yes, Noach was a Noachide, and he was operating on a two-dimensional plane, and in that two-dimensional plane he was number 10, he was a great tzaddik. But Avraham innovates a new dimension. A dimension not only of having. A dimension not only of the measurable. Elohim is measurable God. The God that demands accountability. God that is the judge. God that wants outcome. God that is intolerant of deviation. God that is rewarding and punishing. But Hashem is another side of God. God who is loving, God who is kind, God who is understanding, God who is creative, God who is within us, God who empathizes and sympathizes, God who we feel and He feels us. And Avraham's innovation was, it's the same, it's one God. So now we have the Y-axis too. And the y-axis, there's a need to be able to connect with people. Noach didn't connect with people. Noach was a tzaddik. But he was a tzaddik in his own little house, in his own family. What impact did Noach have on the world? Zero. He didn't influence anybody. Nobody came into his ark other than his family. He wasn't able to convince anybody to change their ways. He wasn't able to save anybody. He had no impact on the rest of the world. He saved his family, and through that he continued the human race. But he didn't change people's behaviors and beliefs. He was operating on a two-dimensional plane. He was doing whatever he was expected to do, but nothing beyond. He wasn't connecting with people. The Hashem was missing. Because when I understand that there's a divine God in me, right inside me, and that same God is inside you, then I connect with you. And you're important to me. And I share things with you, and you share things with me. And we share our vulnerabilities, and our fears, and our concerns, and we talk. And we influence one another. We impact one another. Avraham is an impactor. He changes people. That's the y-axis. Noach was great in his day-to-day activities and his relationship with God, but he didn't develop influence over vast amounts of people in the world. And core to Avraham's belief is, I'm a contributor. I won't take a shoelace from you, King of Sodom. I won't take a thread from you, King of Sodom. I don't need anything from you. I'm a contributor. I'm not a consumer. And I don't, as the Netziv says, I don't convert, and I don't enforce my own religion on others. All I do is I teach. I teach morality, I teach ethics, I teach monotheism. So in summary, if we look at the world, and we say the world is transforming culturally and polarizing religiously and economically. And it's finding itself entrapped between different extremes. On the religious front, there's a Christian fundamentalism, there's a Muslim fundamentalism, there's a secularism. There is a liberal democracy, and there are controlled economies. There's globalization leading to its problems. The economic polarization around the West, driven by consumerism, by the need to have. How do we measure success in Western civilization? How much have you got? In the United States, if you say to somebody, you should see so-and-so, he's a really good doctor, the response could possibly be, really, how much does he make? If he's a good doctor, he must be wealthy, he must be successful. So success, greatness, accomplishment is measured in terms of accumulation. How much have we got? And the whole society is driven by consumerism, by accumulation. Not so in the East, not so in Asia. Asia is driven by a sense of being. It doesn't matter if we accumulate. We'll work for nothing. We'll work through the night. We'll do whatever it takes to get where we want to be ultimately. We don't have to become so attached. And so in the West, we are attached to our materialism. In the East, in Asia, people are able to be unattached to their materialism. Now, it's true that many Westerners, you'll find, running off to the East to find their spirituality. I'm told that the biggest seder on Pesach is in Kathmandu. And it's mostly Israelis there. Looking for themselves. Lech lecha. But Hashem said, Lech lecha, go and find yourself in Israel. And now Israelis are going to India to find themselves. Because the world is lost. In the consumerist society of the West, we've lost our souls. And in the more spiritual societies of the East, there's poverty. And the impoverished people in the East want wealth. And the impoverished people in the West want a soul. And the only common denominator is they're all impoverished, just in different currencies. In the East they're impoverished with money. And in the West they're impoverished spiritually. And we're running around chasing our tails, trying to find the peace we don't have. And the peace we don't have is not somewhere in the middle. Because a compromise and adulteration, both worlds will end up losing their soul. So what is the Katsuv Ashtishi? What is that third dimension that Avraham innovates, that we can use as Jews as we navigate this difficult future. Firstly, we align the God of being, Hashem, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, with Elohim, the God of power. We don't live in the area of material accumulation and consumerism. We don't live in the area of intolerance and absolutism and fundamentalism. Nor do we live in the area of moral relativism. Nor do we live anywhere in between. We are the Ketuvah Shlishi. We know how to integrate the two. How to integrate God's absolute requirements of us as Elohim and God's understanding and empathy for us as Hashem. And we're able to say in our Shema twice a day, Shema Yisrael, listen Jewish people, Hashem Elokeinu, the God of empathy, understanding, creation, intuition inside each of us, is also Elokeinu. He's also the judge. He's also the absolutist. Because in our third dimension, Hashem Echad, it's one God. We contributors rather than consumers. It's interesting when we look at the percentage. I was told the other day that Jews constitute 0.5% of the United States population, I think I was told, and 44% of the American Nobel Prize winners. And that's not because Jews are brighter than non-Jews. That's not the reason. Jews are not brighter than non-Jews. It's easy to prove that. So why are there so many Nobel Prize winners? Because since Avraham, Jews are contributors. We like to make a difference. We like to create. We like to innovate. We like to contribute. Because that way we can be involved in the world without being attached to the world. You become attached when you consume. You become involved when you contribute. In the East there's detachment. In the West there's attachment. The Ketuvah Shlishi is contribute. Be involved, but detached. And thirdly, we abandon the need to dominate and convert in favor of teaching and influencing a universal morality and the belief in one God, irrespective of the specific forms of religious practice. So while fundamentalist Christians have to believe that ultimately all of the world are going to be fundamentalist Christians, just like them, and fundamentalist Muslims have to believe that eventually the entire world is going to be Muslim fundamentalists, just like them, we do not believe that ever will the entire world be Jewish. That's not the intention, it's not the desire, it's not the plan. Every nation, every culture must find their own way of serving God. As long as we're serving the same God, with the same value system, as long as our value system, our interpersonal relationships, are governed by a divine ethic, how we serve God, we have our ways dictated in the Torah, and each religion will develop their own. And so our role is not to proselytize, but to teach. It's not to control, but to influence. Using not only superior power or status, but the commanding force of our own character. The personal stature that we evolve as we grow in a true understanding of God's Torah and the authentic practice of His mitzvahs. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.